I often talk about the idea that we only have to learn to manage four things. Matter, that's solid stuff. Energy, not solid stuff. Space, and time. Looking at my desk with the mail from the last 7 or 8 weeks piled up shows me that I am not expert at managing any of these four items. I let matter build up in piles. I don't engage with certain forms of energy, such as money, or creating the webinars that I have in mind from my Sunday talks, or using journaling as the source. I put stuff on horizontal surfaces, which represents space to me. And those spaces are not really designed to be way stations for paperwork and books and magazines and unread, unopened mail, and so on. I even emptied suitcases and left the contents on my bed, even though when I looked at it, I thought, oh, that clothing could easily be put right into my closet on the shelves where it belongs. And the other day I was journaling, and it was 4:30 p.m., even though I started the process of getting ready to journal a couple of hours earlier. Somehow, other requirements and things that actually were not requirements got put ahead of journaling in my time schedule on that day. This is one of the reasons why journaling, for me, and this is a standard recommendation, needs to take place early in the morning, because a lot of things can jump in front of journaling if you delay it for later in the day. That I have proven to myself time and time again. For me, being willing to engage with money, and I'm talking about money as one of the things we need to manage, because it is near and dear to most of our hearts. But being willing to engage with money without the misemotion that I tend to associate with it would impact everything: matter, energy, space, and time. When you think of it, if you can manage money, then somehow everything else that you tend to manage seems to be a little easier to do. If I had, let's say, skill, and I had understanding and awareness of how to manage money, then the other day I could, as I was looking at the mail, I could efficiently decide on which donations to make. And then once I decided, immediately, I would actually write the check or fill in the credit card information or go online and do it. Instead, I tended to vacillate. Should I? Should I not? Is this a good thing? Is it not a good thing? How much should I give? How much should I not give? That sort of thing. And had I decided instead of vacillated, then that would have moved mail off of my desk and out of my mind. I would have saved a lot of time that I spent going in this loop of should I not. It occurred to me that there must be some effective way to look at any situation in which a necessary energy engagement does not occur. We know we have certain chores, we have certain responsibilities, we have certain duties, and of course we've got desires and we've got goals, but when they don't occur, what's going on? Think of that for yourself. What situations are you not dealing with? What situations or topics are you not managing? If I were to draw a stick figure, which represents me, or it could represent you, right? That's us. And on off to the other side of the paper, I would put an image. It could be a box, could be a circle, could be a dollar sign if I were talking about money, or it could be any kind of image that represents the situation or the topic with which we are not managing effectively. If you have these two figures in front of you on a piece of paper, I would say that the balance between those two figures could be considered a form of understanding that energy is able to move back and forth between you and it, between me and it. it seems to me that understanding is what allows energy to flow easily so as to achieve a sense of balance. Understanding is the result of three things. Affinity. That's the physical closeness between two participants. So I'm talking about affinity on a physical level. Reality is a closeness maybe on a spiritual and or mental and or on emotional level. That is, you're thinking and you're feeling and about the item at hand is in balance. It's not dangerous. It's not threat. It is something that you can relate to and understand and appreciate and put your attention on. And I would say respect. Communication, the third item, is how energy flows between us and it. How it goes back and forth, back and forth. And this is what is necessary when we put attention on any topic. If you took out your checkbook right now and you put your attention on it, that is a form of communication. You're looking at it, the light is being reflected off your checkbook, back into your eyes, you're processing that signal through your nervous system, and you would be looking at, say, page after page, balance and credits and deposits and debits and so on. So we're talking about affinity, reality, and communication. In Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth, Christ talks about that we need to change our beliefs in order to heal, rather than to try to improve our lives or try to heal ourselves. By changing our beliefs, everything starts to shift. And it makes sense to me that the items that Christ discovered out in the desert that the divine is seeking to deliver to all of its creation for their well-being, that is, growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, rhythm, and all being governed by the law of cause and effect, can actually be at work in our lives. We would tend to resist much less if we could change our beliefs and open ourselves up and trust. Now, if what Christ says, we need, in order to do anything like this, we just need to change our beliefs. I believe that to be true. So, if that's true, then we have to look at who and what has beliefs in the situations that I just diagrammed. I assume that money doesn't have beliefs of its own, and that only living beings like you and me and maybe animals can have their own beliefs because we're able to create it as we process environmental signals. I do believe, however, and Christ references this as well, that inanimate objects such as cars, electronic devices, homes, equipment, etc., can absorb the energy of people and then either function better or malfunction because of the energy that they've absorbed. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to assume that I, as a person, can have beliefs, and money, as an object, does not. One of the more interesting concepts in life is the polarity present in electromagnetic things. For example, on my refrigerator, I have a whole bunch of magnets. So, if I took two magnets and I move them close together, depending on the orientation of the magnetic poles of each of these magnets I have in my hands, they will either attract one another very quickly, snap together, or they will strongly resist all my attempts to push them together. Now, you're probably familiar with that idea with magnets, and it's kind of fun to deal with that. Like, how I can't get these two together. I think that's at play when we're not able to manage things. According to Christ, everything in our world is electromagnetic, including people, things, images that we form in our minds, ideas, thoughts, are all electromagnetic. That would mean that me and even my beliefs are electromagnetic, And the concept of money and the various forms of money, let's say paper, you know, dollar bills and $50 bills and $100 bills, checks, coins, and if I'm looking at my accounts online, the electrons online, they're all electromagnetic too. In order to change my relationship to anything I want to manage, I should start with my beliefs. I think the same is true for you. You might want to consider that. If you want to manage something more effectively than you're currently managing it, what would you need to change in the way of your beliefs? I assume that my beliefs are what control my electromagnetic state. If you were to look at me, and if you could consider that around me, I have this energy field, auric field, biofield, that it changes depending on what I put my attention on. This is where we talk about psychological reversal or polarity reversal. Now, depending on what I put my attention on is going to affect my electromagnetic state. Now, if I put my attention on money, and money is a threat, it's a saber-toothed tiger, or if it overwhelms or dominates me, you can imagine that the polarity of my biofield, my auric field, is going to change. Hold that thought. I guess that my beliefs can be complicated, as can yours. For example, I can believe that money is fill in a blank, X, Y, Z, hard to get, easy to get, the source of all evil, you know, these kind of things that we've heard as children. So we can define money in a lot of different ways. So if I believe those things, that's one thing. I also have my beliefs about myself in relation to money. So if money, now I'm talking about the diagram, right, that stick figure, if that's me or you, in relation to money, that is when we put our money, our attention on money, it's like, oh, I'm overwhelmed, I'm confused, I'm tired, I'm afraid, I'm fill in the blank. We can have all kinds of things being triggered, and of course, that affects our electromagnetic field. My beliefs can be about my being in relation to money. They can be about my doing in relation to money, and can be about my having in relation to money. I've noticed this. I tend to have a lot of money, but I tend to get rid of it really fast. So a lot of money can come in, and a lot of money goes out. So instead of preserving, which is the second step of my energy model of life, acquiring preservation of the energy I have acquired, and then translation of it. So those things are not effectively handled. So to earn a lot of money, make a lot of money, but then to get rid of it, sometimes foolishly, is an issue that can be looked at. Marianne used to teach a personality profiling system called DISC. D stands for dominant, I for influential, S for steady, and C for conscientious. And it depends, you know, how we like to receive information, how we like to give information. I happen to be a CS, conscientious, steady personality type. Trouble is with that, I always need more information. I need more information. I need more information. And this is where perfectionism also falls into place. And the steadies don't like risk. They don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to go down a path that is going to lead them into any kind of pain or suffering or difficulty. So besides being a perfectionist and being risk avoidant, then you can see making decisions, making progress can be a complicated process. And as a CEO, I say, I don't have enough information. I need more information. And the trouble is, when you start on that process, say you're going to evaluate purchasing an item, you start on the research process. By the time you're done, some of the stuff you analyzed early on is obsolete. New products and new models have come out. And you're, oh, geez, Louise, I got to start all over again. If you turn around and look even deeper, there could be beliefs that I have or you have about our deservingness. Do we deserve to have as much money as we want, as we create? How does this impact our personal value and worthiness? It's hard to have money if you're not worthy, if you don't personally have value. Or, if you've done something wrong over the course of your life, who hasn't, with regard to money, then maybe punishment. Oh, I shouldn't have money because, I deserve to be punished for stealing a pack of chewing gum when I was 5 years old. People buy into that all the time. I use the 10 emotional states as a way to evaluate the state of the biofield, the electromagnetic field in which I am and also clients are in with regard to any particular topic. And if I look at the lower 7 out of these 10, shame, apathy, grief, fear, lust, anger, and pride, and if I were to choose any one of those, regarding money, 0 to 10, 10 being highest, how much shame do I have? And then you wait for that number to come to mind and you write it down. Regarding money, how much apathy do I have? And you wait for that number to come to mind and you write it down. Regarding money, how much grief do I have? You wait till that number comes to mind and you write it down. And the same with fear, and the same with lust, the same with anger, and the same with pride. Then you would be able to look at that and go, I've got beliefs that hold me and my energy field, my electromagnetic state, in shame, which is, of course, a sense that we are defective, we're broken. It's not a temporary thing. It's assumed to be permanent, which, of course, is false. But from a belief standpoint, it tends to be, once the glass is broken, it's broken. Now, you can glue it back together again, but it's still a broken glass. It's not unbroken. In human beings, that can be healed. So if you were to turn around and add this complication to the process, people, I know this to be true for myself, we negotiate with God as children. Oh, God, if you'll save me from fill in the blank, I promise to end. We make vows. We hold ourselves to them as if God wants to have us at the negotiating table, trying to get things from us that we're trying to hold on to. That's a human characteristic. That's not a God characteristic. But since we're told that, and I heard a rock and roll song, or a country western song, really, the other day. That big man up in the sky, folks, there is no big man up in the sky. That is what you tell a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old child in order to get their obedience. And if you're holding on to beliefs like that because somebody convinced you that you should be obedient to their point of view, it's time for you to heal that. But giving up what we want, because we've negotiated with God, and we were like, I gave it away. I gave up happiness to have my life saved. We can undo that error. It's an error in belief. It's not an error in actuality. We manage time, or at least we try to. If you were to review your daily or your weekly activities, you're going to notice whether you're generally effective in managing time or you're generally ineffective managing time. If you tend to be late for appointments, guess what that would represent? If you're incredibly early for appointments, guess what that means. If you're on time for appointments, that's another thing entirely. If I were to draw another diagram, and this one is a horizontal line, I'm going to call it a timeline. It's a handy way to review the past, the present, and the future of our lives. And for my purposes today, I just want to talk about using a timeline as a way to identify when beliefs may have been created and where, by identifying the obvious context in which they may have been created. So if you draw a horizontal timeline, and frankly, I decide or I recommend to people that they start a timeline 3 months before they were conceived and go out to, well, my case, 120 years old. So now you're looking at something that is 121 years long, that timeline. So follow me on this. I was born March 5th, 1946, right after World War II. That says that I was conceived in around June of 1945. World War II in Europe ended in May 1945. And Japan was on the verge of surrendering. They were collapsing, and they would ultimately surrender in September of 1945. My parents already had 4 children when I was conceived. And then they had number 6 and number 7 after me. I later became aware of how difficult it was to afford all these children. And there's no doubt in my mind that my mother, as she's pregnant with her 5th child, recognizes this kind of concept. I can't afford, or we can't afford, or can't afford. Well, can't afford what? Well, we only manage 4 things, right? We can't afford a 5th child because we don't have enough space. How many bedrooms do 5 children take? And we don't have enough time to take care of these 5 children and meet all these needs. And in terms of energy, we don't have enough money. We can't afford the energy, the money, to supply all their needs. How much food do 5 children consume? 7 if you add in my parents, and they ate as well. And you go like, phew, and clothing, matter? How do you afford all the matter that's necessary to meet the needs of all these people? No question in my mind that my mother didn't have enough time, and she would have conceptualized that. Not enough time, not enough energy to handle 5 children. Years later, when I lived in Manhattan and I had friends on the 6th floor, I lived on the 9th floor, they had 2 small children, so they became our close friends, and we loved their children. But it occurred to me that it takes 2 adults full-time to satisfy the needs of 1 child. 2 adults, full-time. Guess what? Very few people have full-time in their schedule to devote to a single child. They have to work. They have their other needs. They devote attention to one another. So there's going to be not enough time, not enough energy to devote to the care of these people as you have these children. If you can imagine that in utero, these concepts of can't afford, not enough energy, not enough time, were inputted to me when I was in the womb, you would think, one of the considerations that I've noticed over the years, in contrast to Marianne, is I would question whether I had enough energy for X, or if I had enough time to do Project Y. Marianne didn't have those considerations. She would see a project that needed to be done, she'd do it, boom, boom. And we're like, wow, why is it so complicated for me and not so complicated for her? How about beliefs? The difference in our beliefs. So if you think about the amount of care that you received or didn't receive when you were a child, you're like, make sense. And as an infant, basically, when we don't get our needs met the way we want, we have the choice of either to succumb, I can't have my needs met, nobody cares, and then we fall asleep as a result of that. Or, depending on our personalities, we fight and we scream and kick and we escalate that because we're angry and we're trying to force the environment to meet our needs. So, succumb and give up, or be angry and battle to try to get our needs met. One of my older sisters, Patty, she was older by about 4 years, told me she was heartbroken because my mother wouldn't pick me up once when I was in a crib sobbing. I have some sort of sense of that experience, but I don't know what was going on in me other than the physical act of sobbing and wanting to be held or comforted or consoled or something. Patty had physical heart problems in childhood and throughout her life, all related to the lack of love. No, not only the lack of love that she saw not being distributed to me, but which was not distributed and delivered to her. She was the third girl in a row. Girl, 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 then my brother John, then me, and then my sister Anne, and then my brother George. So Patty, as a third girl, it's like, we didn't want a third girl. We were looking for a boy. So you're really in the way. And that kind of input after birth, not that helpful to a person and their full development of a heart. During World War II, my father was a foreman in an aircraft factory in Queens, New York. He was educated as an attorney, so that's what he was trained to do. He didn't want to be an attorney. He wanted to be a college professor, but his father insisted that he needed, after the war, to build a law practice. He wasn't very successful as a lawyer. He didn't want to be a lawyer, so you can imagine the resistance that he had to that. So now, if you add in a job dissatisfaction of returning to build a law practice, which he didn't want to do, the insufficient income to provide for 5 children, then 6 children, then 7 children, and all of this going on, you can imagine that the environment that I grew up in, or that my siblings were in, was very stressful and potentially volatile and unhappy. Recently, I did a Sunday talk on values and their influence on our actions. Values were talked about frequently in my family of origin. That was a good thing, although I saw plenty of evidence that do as I say, not what I do. It's like, don't smoke, but you're smoking. Don't drink, but you're drinking. Don't do this, but you're doing that. And as an attorney, my father preached honesty and lawfulness. Now, that makes sense, right? Because he was defending people who were caught at being dishonest and violating the law. And he was a police justice, so he was the judge in those kind of situations as well. So on the timeline, I could mark events in which I was dishonest. And I have multiple experiences of dishonesty regarding money as a child. Those experiences mean I would have drawn some conclusions and some interpretations about money, myself, my fears of being caught, regret about violating the family values. Oh, if my family knew that I did something this dishonest, I would be disowned, I would be shunned, I would, whatever. And more. And I'm not even factoring in any possible experiences from previous lives, although I do believe these things can impinge upon us. Just think of what could happen in a person's life if regret, guilt, bad feelings about oneself were strongly connected to money. Every time money is involved, you know, bad things happen. And we would avoid that like it were a snake. And this idea that we can associate pain and suffering and humiliation, embarrassment, and badness to any topic, you know, food or clothing or fill in school or fill in the blank. And then we would avoid it like it were a tremendous risk to get close to it, to increase our affinity for it. To back up, I want to reiterate the electromagnetic nature of people, thoughts, and beliefs. If there is something that we want to be, or do, or have, but can't seem to make progress toward it, we have to look at the beliefs that repel what we now want, but which were probably created to protect us from the emotional and physical pain that we associated with those past experiences in which we did get what we want, but afterwards, uh-oh, I got more than what I wanted. I got pain and guilt and regret and other consequences. Over the summer, I arranged for a reading over the telephone from a psychic named Marcia, who had been recommended to me. I am very familiar with psychics, and Marcia was good. 2 points I want to refer to that were made in that reading. One was that I had a sense of fear that was from a past life. And it had to do with the fear of being attacked by people for something I did or an attitude I expressed or, anyway, people turned on me. And now that was underlying fear that I could heal and, frankly, needed to heal. The second point was a process to heal the fears, to help bring them into focus and deal with the connections that were holding me back. I thought, oh, that's cool. Now, Marcia was the third psychic to recommend mirror therapy in one form or another to me, with the first one being in Brooklyn in 1976. That's a few years ago. So here's the process that Marcia outlined. One, sit in front of a mirror and look at yourself in the eyes. There's you and you are present. Speaking aloud, ask for your higher self or Christ or any aspect of the source of all life to be present and supportive in the process. Third was to start a conversation, again, aloud, talking about the fears that you have on this subject, the issues that are pressing you down related to this subject, whatever feels like is holding you back or is blocking you or is an impediment or anything else that you think is germane to this particular situation. Talk as long as you want to talk. When you're done talking, for 1 minute or so, close your eyes and see yourself and your other self. Imagine those two selves, you and you. Your other self will be tied with ropes. Imagine you take a pair of large scissors, make the motions of cutting the ropes that bind the other you, and say aloud, "You are free, and so am I." And then see your other self now walking away, getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and say to your other self, "Bless you in one way or another. God bless you. Bless us both." However you want to say that, you want to send that other self off with feelings from you of it being loved. Marcia recommended that I do this process 2 times. The second time should be about 3 weeks after the first time. She pointed out that you could feel drained after you do it the first time, but energized in a sense of clarity are going to occur when you do it the second time. And it seems to me that the release of the weight from these unresolved fears and situations, which we haven't talked about, we hold them in, and you know nobody knows about these secrets, have now been exposed. We brought them up, looked at us and us, and gives us a new sense of freedom and power. And from that point on, the ability for us to move forward, to create and express our true potential in life will be even greater. Then we're going to be in a position to manage not only money, but matter and space and time and other forms of energy. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know that you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal, loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.